Welcome back, everyone. We're going to continue with our program today and focus on GU cancers for the next hour or so. We're going to start out with a program focused on bladder and prostate cancer. And actually, we're going to follow that up with one of our first special virtual mini modules with Professor Pals from the UK talking about renal cell cancer. Everybody could have a seat. We can get started here. So I want to welcome Alicia Morgans from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Dr. Evan Yu from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle. So Alicia, when I first saw the program, I'm like, what's Courtney DiNardo's picture doing on the cover? And they're like, that's not Courtney, that's Alicia. So I don't know if it's like a separated, your identical twin. You told me you actually trained with her?
We did, we were in residency together many years ago at Penn. So it is my honor to be compared with Courtney DiNardo.
And Courtney's actually presented this meeting many times. Of course, she's been a leader in the treatment of AML. But anyhow, we're here to talk about prostate cancer, urothelial bladder cancer. And we're going to begin with prostate cancer. And actually, Alicia, in a second, I'm going to ask you to begin. But I just want to start, Evan, maybe you just want to comment in general, some of the global changes that you've seen in prostate cancer over the last few years. It seemed like 3 or 4 years ago, there wasn't that much talk about it. Now, all of a sudden, it's just a huge, huge amount of new information. From your perspective globally, Evan, what are some of the major changes you've seen in prostate cancer?
Yeah, I mean, I think prostate cancer, if you rewind the clock to when I got back into this field, which was right when docetaxel was FDA approved, that's when I first started on faculty, just count it up. I mean, things have changed dramatically. Look at all the different agents we have. You look at all the trials and look at the median survival. Patients are living longer, they're doing better. And I think the thing to remember is, if you look at the press for what people talk about with prostate cancer, it's always like over-treatment, screening, et cetera. Most people die with prostate cancer, not because, not this patient population. This patient population we're talking about, they die because of prostate cancer, but they're living a lot longer now. And I think that, you know, that's revolutionary. I'm just feel lucky to be in this field.
So we're going to start to go through some of the big changes. And of course, I guess it was last year's GU symposium where we saw several really important trials that Alicia and we'll be talking about here today. So if you could please get started. And this is, I guess, a good way to begin.
Great.
Propel.
Yes, thank you. So PROPEL is actually a first-line metastatic CRPC study that was presented at GU ASCO this past year, as we've heard. So patients progressing into that first line who had not had prolonged exposure to abiraterone in the metastatic hormone-sensitive setting could be enrolled and were randomized to treatment with abiraterone with or without olaparib. And these were all continued until the time of progression, with radiographic progression-free survival being the primary endpoint here. Importantly, I should emphasize that PROPEL was looking at patients not just who had these HRR or DNA repair defect alterations, but included an all-comer population, and they did not need genetic testing prior to enrollment and randomization. This was something that was assessed on the back end. What we can see here is that on the left, the primary endpoint of radiographic progression-free survival by the investigator's assessment and the radiographic progression-free survival by the blinded internal central review were both prolonged with the combination of abiraterone and olaparib versus abiraterone alone in this all-comer population, which is really, really important. At the bottom of this slide, we can see that this seemed to be most pronounced in those patients who had HRR mutations with the hazard ratio of 0.5. But even among patients who did not have HRR mutations, the hazard ratio was statistically significant at 0.76. I just want to emphasize it's an RPFS endpoint here. So we did get some updated information here. The updated RPFS showed a very similar hazard ratio here, the 0.67. So this, for the overall population, seemed to hold. And we also saw a prolongation for the combination with the time to the next therapy and PFS2 also being prolonged in this all-comers population. And here we can see overall survival, not yet mature. And this may not be completely mature, I was told, by the time of the ultimate analysis. Obviously, overall survival, not the primary endpoint, so it's not powered for that. But they're continuing to follow. They have another data cut coming up. When we look at subgroups, we can see that this seems to be a fairly uniform benefit across all of the subgroups assessed here. Again, most pronounced benefit all the way at the bottom of this plot among those patients who have HRR alterations, but even among those who are wild type, there was a statistically significant benefit and hazard ratio suggesting that benefit. And in terms of adverse events, always important when we're combining therapies, especially in this case, we have an active control arm of abiraterone single agent in first-line MCRPC. This is a very active control arm. If we're going to actually add to that with a olaparib, we need to make sure it's not going to be too toxic for our patients. There was not any evidence of synergistic adverse events. Both of these drugs have their own adverse event profile, which seemed to be upheld. There were some thromboembolic complications that I do think we need to keep our eye on, but these were not clinically significant. They were radiographically identified. In contrast, Magnitude was a study in, again, first-line MCRPC. Patients could have had exposure to docetaxel, but could not have had progression on abiraterone in that metastatic hormone-sensitive setting. Patients were enrolled, but were enrolled in two cohorts, one biomarker positive, so they're identifying the biomarker from the beginning, one biomarker negative cohort. In both cohorts, there was a randomization to abiraterone with or without niraparib and followed for a primary endpoint here of radiographic progression-free survival. Here we see that we only see results in those patients who are HRR positive. And that is because the HRR negative or wild type population actually was that enrollment and assessment was stopped because of a blinded internal central review by the Data Safety Monitoring Committee that found essentially futility in biomarker negative patients for the combination of abiraterone and niraparib. That was no better than abiraterone alone. As we can see in the biomarker positive population, the combination was associated with the prolongation of radiographic progression-free survival, most pronounced among BRCA1 and BRCA2 patients. And here we can see again, most pronounced among those patients who have BRCA1, BRCA2. AEs, again, additive but not synergistic, some cytopenias, some GI effects. And then the other big update that I wanted to emphasize today is in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, we've seen the advent of triplet therapy really rising to the top in that first-line treatment of HSPC. ADT alone, no longer an option. Doublets are now becoming triplets. PEACE-1 is a relatively complex design, but ultimately, in the analysis that we're going to look at in a moment, we're looking at ADT, most patients also getting docetaxel, and then adding abiraterone versus ADT, most patients also getting docetaxel, so no abiraterone. And what we can see here in radiographic progression-free survival, ADT and predominantly receiving, this is all patients, this is just the docetaxel analysis, so ADT, docetaxel, abiraterone, having superior radiographic progression-free survival versus ADT docetaxel. And here we can see overall survival also being prolonged in that patient population getting abiraterone in addition to ADT docetaxel versus ADT docetaxel. ARASENS, much cleaner design, patients with MHSPC. These patients could have been de novo, they could have had recurrent disease, they could be high volume, they could be low volume. Most patients were de novo metastatic and high volume. They were randomized to treatment with ADT docetaxel plus darolutamide versus ADT and docetaxel. So does darolutamide add to the ADT docetaxel backbone? Primary endpoint here, overall survival. The addition of darolutamide significantly prolongs overall survival in patients who were fit to get ADT docetaxel versus ADT docetaxel alone. So more progress here. The triplet makes a clear benefit, including in secondary endpoints, time to CRPC and time to pain progression. Enzamet, also looking at these patients, ADT docetaxel plus enzalutamide versus ADT docetaxel plus nilutamide, flutamide, or bicalutamide. This was complex. Some patients did not receive docetaxel, I should emphasize, but a majority did. And here we can see the overall survival benefit to the addition of enzalutamide to the backbone, whether that's ADT docetaxel or ADT alone versus ADT or ADT docetaxel. So enzalutamide is additive as well. Consistent through subgroups, they did think those patients who had de novo metastatic and high volume metastatic may benefit the most from the triplet again, but this is a complex breakdown here. Interestingly, low volume patients seem to benefit the most from the addition of enzalutamide. I wouldn't dig too much into this just given the small subsets. But in conclusion, lots of stuff to discuss here. PARP inhibitor combinations suggest a potential synergy between PARP inhibitors and AR-targeted treatments, at least with abiraterone, as we saw in these studies. The overall survival data is still maturing, but ongoing studies are also going to be needed to help us understand if it's the combination of olaparib and abiraterone or niraparib and abiraterone that's better, or is it that we can sequence these agents and get these benefits over time for our patients. Triplet therapies seem to suggest that the addition of darolutamide or abiraterone to ADT and docetaxel is associated with improved overall survival. When we add enzalutamide to a standardized backbone, we also get benefit, though the triplet, I would say, is a little less clear in that study. So those are our big updates in advanced prostate cancer.
So let's dissect that out a little bit. We've talked about the challenge of medical oncology. Every single one of these modules today packed with new information. And I'm here to try to see whether or not we can bring it down to practical clinical application. So Evan, beginning with PARP inhibitors, one thing that's kind of interesting in terms of these two trials that Alicia talked about is this issue of the benefit in patients who non-HRR patients. We're gonna be talking about PARP later on this afternoon in ovarian, and interestingly there, we saw the benefit with niraparib in that population, and maybe probably olaparib as well, though that's less studied. Any thoughts about the clinical application? The other issue about these data is particularly the PROPEL studies using abiraterone. Can you extend that out to other forms of hormonal therapy, specifically enzalutamide? So first of all, any thoughts in general about the data and sort of how you see applying it in your practice moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, quite surprising data. And what I would say is that it definitely is showing something and doing something. How it works, I think, is unclear. I think one can hypothesize for those that don't have DNA repair, you know, alterations, that there's some other mechanism of action that PARP inhibitors are doing. And you know, at high enough doses, it can cause cell cycle arrest, et cetera. Or there are other alterations, genetic alterations, that actually predispose to response to PARP inhibitors that we're just not smart enough in this day and age to identify. And it might, like most things in life, be multifactorial, a little bit of everything. But it's enough to lead to what looks like some efficacy benefit for those patients that are not identified as DNA repair deficient, at least in this day and age, how we define it. So I think it's really interesting to get to your second point. What about other AR-targeted agents like enzalutamide? There was just a press release with talazoparib and enzalutamide. Now, we haven't seen all the data yet, and the devil's always in the details, so we have to see that data. But I think it's starting to line up. In the beginning, when it's one study, I'm like, I don't get how it works. There's toxicity as the PARP inhibitors. There's no overall survival data yet. I'm not that enthusiastic. But then you line up the next study and the next study, and you have to start saying, well, this is real, and maybe we ought to be doing this. Not quite there yet. I still want to see the talazoparib data with enzalutamide, but I'm certainly getting there.
So speaking of not quite there or quite there, of course, regulatory issues, reimbursement always come into play. But in general, we're sort of putting that aside and really trying to focus on the clinical risk benefit and what you, whether or not you think it would be useful for a patient. So let's get real practical, Alicia. Let's say you have a patient with a BRCA germline mutation. For some reason, you see more BRCA2 in prostate cancer. In what situations would you like to be able to integrate a PARP inhibitor? Which PARP inhibitor?
That's a great question, and I think so importantly, we need to recognize that patients who have BRCA2 have a poorer prognosis in terms of their overall life expectancy and response to therapies. They tend to respond for a shorter period of time, and that's been shown in numerous studies just in terms of, you know, response to treatment as compared to their wild-type counterparts. That being said, I think that if you have a patient who's young, fit, robust, can get approval, insurance approval for both abiraterone and I would say olaparib seems to have a potentially more experience in my hands is what I would say in terms of all of the PARPs, I would feel more comfortable with that agent, although everybody may have their own comfort level with different agents. Niraparib may be the one that you use for other diseases and maybe better in your hands. In any event, for young patients with BRCA2, if they're willing, they understand it's a PFS benefit right now, not overall survival, and I don't have sequencing information to demonstrate whether the synergy is better than the sequence. I think they could consider it.
So, and we'll get to the non-HRR in a second, but Evan, on the other hand is the downside. And I'm curious, again, in this patient population, how you see both immediate and long-term issues. Again, so much more experience, and we're going to, again, we'll talk about it this afternoon in ovarian cancer. But, of course, you hear about GI issues, you hear about cytopenias. I'm not sure if they play out differently in a man with prostate cancer and a lot of bone mets. What's your take on both short and long-term MDS and AML in the long-term? I don't know how relevant that is in this situation, but any thoughts about sort of the downside you're looking at?
Absolutely. I think the most common thing that I hear from my patients that I give a PARP inhibitor to is they just say, yeah, I don't have much appetite, just vague GI complaints. And they're the types of things that when you look at an adverse event table from a clinical trial, they don't hit you in the face. It doesn't look terrible because they're usually like grade 1-2 events. But they're clinically and impactful for quality of life. And so these are things that I counsel my patient about in advance before I start them on a PARP inhibitor. And I would say my number one management strategy is I actually dose reduce pretty quickly. And I am curious about whether I'm doing the right thing or not, because I wonder whether some of the benefit, you know, progression-free survival benefit from these agents are from off-target effects at higher doses. So I have some concern and battle within myself, but, you know, your patients have to feel good. They have to have good quality of life. And so that's one thing that I think about is early dose reductions. In regards to the cytopenias, you know, severe cytopenias, MDS, AML, that's rare. Have I seen it? Yes, I have seen it. When you treat enough patients, it can happen. I think the risk-benefit ratios generally with PARP inhibitors, especially those that have DNA repair deficiency, the benefit outweighs the risk. But it's something I keep a close watch on. And, you know, fortunately, it's not a high number of patients that have that.
Alicia, I'm curious, what about the non-HRR patient? Again, in ovarian cancer, niraparib is commonly used in this situation. There is a decent hazard rate. There's a decent hazard rate for olaparib, I think 0.76. If you could, would you offer it to a patient?
That's $1 million question. So I think that there actually have been multiple studies that suggest that there is synergy here and gives an opportunity for people who don't otherwise have any clear evidence of benefit from PARP to potentially benefit from PARP. So that's really appealing. As we just heard, I think it's Talipro 2 that's demonstrating that synergy between talazoparib and enzalutamide, which is new data. We haven't seen it yet. But study 8, actually a number of years ago, was reported that was the data that led to the phase 3 for PROPEL, and that also showed this synergy, even among wild-type patients. So that's a fairly consistent message. However, right now we have a PFS endpoint. If we had an OS endpoint, I would offer it. Sort of barring that, I think it's a very unique patient that I would offer to. Very young, very motivated.
So one of the themes, again, that we get into today is when you have multiple agents available in the same class. We were talking about PD-1 before, and the lung cancer doc said, I don't think there's a difference, but there you go with the data. And stage 3 locally advanced, they have data with durvalumab, they use durvalumab. First-line mets, they have it with pembro, or they use it there. So you're often following the data. And as Evan said, now we're starting to see trials that are about to be presented. Here's one with rucaparib. We actually just saw at ASCO a big paper on rucaparib in ovarian cancer. It looked identical to what we had seen with the other two PARP inhibitors. Now we have rucaparib here. Interestingly, they include ATM mutations, Evan, which brings in the issue of what beyond BRCA, at least theoretically, you know, approvals, et cetera, reimbursement's different. You have ATM, PALB2, you have somatic mutations, Evan. Any thoughts about PARP inhibitors based on these other abnormalities?
Yeah. First off, I want to say that I might have said talazoparib earlier, and so this just goes to show what you're bringing up, a class effect thing, and I meant rucaparib, so I apologize.
There is a restatement. Here's the talazoparib.
Right, there's talazoparib data,
too. There is a talazoparib.
But there's rucaparib data, too. And, you know, so I'm going to address that one first is, right now, I mean, there's differences in terms of PARP trapping and enzymatic activity. I don't know that we can see a difference. There are some drug-drug interaction differences, but I can't say that we can see a clinical difference. Now, to get to the other question, which is the question about different gene mutations, ATM, CHEK2, et cetera, versus BRCA, I think the data so far shows that the BRCA2 mutant patients, that they clearly respond the best. And that I think when it comes to almost everything else other than maybe PALB2, where I think those patients are going to respond and the biology makes sense, I think it's not completely clear. The other thing I'm a big believer in is, you know, loss of heterozygosity. You know, do you what is the zygosity status? And many of these assays don't give us information on that. I know that the niraparib studies, they did, you know, mandate that patients had biallelic alteration. But in most studies, it doesn't make a statement. Here's what I'll say. If you have a BRCA2 alteration, that's usually truncal, that occurs early, that's impactful, that's a driver, and you almost always have loss of heterozygosity. So you find it, it's probably there, you're going to respond. ATM, big gene, you get lots of problems, like you're doing a circulating tumor DNA assay, you get CHIP, you know, all kinds of interference that may not be real or a real driver of the tumor. So I think, you know, we have to be careful and really think about the gene, whether it's monoallelic, whether it's biallelic. These are things the field still has to sort out.
So it looks like we are going to see some more data with other PARP inhibitors, and I wouldn't doubt over the next few years, lots of data. It's interesting you mentioned PALB2. We were doing a program with Dr. Johann de Bono, who's been a real leader in this field. And he said, well, I call PALB2 BRCA3. That made me feel a lot better, maybe kind of gave me a better understanding of kind of what it meant. So, Alicia, you also got into this hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, metastatic disease. And again, I'm kind of a simple person, and like all those studies you put up, to me, I'm like, okay, it comes down to, are you going to add in a docetaxel to hormonal therapy, and yet most of these trials were adding hormonal therapy onto docetaxel. So, like, who do we have evidence in that using a triplet is better than using a doublet with just hormones?
Yeah, so I think the first point is, and you already get it because, you know, you're a guru at this, is that we don't use ADT alone. That is the number one thing for us to take from all of this. The contribution of docetaxel to an ADT and AR targeted agent backbone has not been defined at this point. And I don't know that we're going to have a study that clearly defines that specific question. What I would say is that chemotherapy has demonstrated effectiveness in multiple studies in the metastatic hormone sensitive setting. If you treat a patient with ADT docetaxel, you need to add an AR-targeted agent. That's not hard. We use these AR-targeted agents all the time. They're well-tolerated, and I think of it as a maintenance phase after we finish the chemotherapy, and it clearly prolongs overall survival. So this is that triplet, and that's when I'm thinking about it. Ultimately, docetaxel for most of my patients is not a now or never. It's now or when. So if I don't give it in the hormone-sensitive setting, that's often what I'm going to in first-line mCRPC. So if I can give it now, get away with 6 cycles, and then have this maintenance, prolonged survival, prolonged time to next therapy, rather than give it after progression on an AR-targeted agent, I might get more out of the docetaxel, because it seems with every therapy, the earlier we give it in our lines, the more effect we get. And I'm also giving 6 cycles in a patient who's probably more fit than 10 cycles in a few years, when that patient has declined in terms of performance status, perhaps, and is older with perhaps more comorbidity. So it's a pretty strong, compelling argument for me. If a patient is chemo fit, I use a triplet. And I think that we don't have evidence that that's not helping the patient, because we are going to give chemo for any chemo fit patient at some point in the future.
Maybe also something, again, one of the themes we're talking about today is patient involvement, when they want to be involved, and whether you use chemo in this situation, I think, is something you could bring up to the patient.
Absolutely.
The other thing I wanted to pick apart before we get into lutetium, which has been one of the most exciting things in oncology, period, is choice of hormonal strategy. So, Evan, we have the M0 PSA only situation and the hormone-sensitive metastatic disease that are the two common situations where we've seen a lot of data and different anti-androgens. So starting out, first of all, with anti-androgens, we have 3 available. There is the feeling we're actually doing a webinar next week with Matt Smith, your colleague from Dana-Farber, and of course, he's had a leadership role in the Arisons trial and darolutamide. It is said, and he's one of the people who says it, Evan, that there's less toxicity, less of the, quote, fatigue that you see with anti-androgen. He's done work on falls maybe being less with darolutamide. So any thoughts about the use of the choice of anti-androgen, either in the M0 or hormone-sensitive setting, Evan?
Yeah, sure. So again, we always have this disclaimer where we're not supposed to compare one randomized trial to the next one, and lay them together side by side. Then we followed up by saying, well, you know, we do it a little bit. But here's what I will say. Although we technically can't compare them side by side, we can look at the treatment arm versus the control arm. And I think we see fewer differences on the darolutamide studies between the treatment arm with darolutamide versus the control arm in adverse events tables. And so that's really all I'll say about that, is I do believe that that is impactful, and I think there probably are less side effects and fatigue, et cetera, with darolutamide. Based on that, I think there's just fewer differences.
So one more issue about M0 disease, Alicia. I'm going to present a case next week to Matt from a general medical oncologist in Texas who used abiraterone prednisone with M0 disease. And I'm like, I didn't know that it's not approved there. I don't know how much data there is there. And she was like, yeah, but it's generic. So is there a rationale to use you? If you saw that patient in a second opinion, would you say you shouldn't do that? Or what would you say?
So I think you mean M0 CRPC, non-metastatic CRPC, where you're right. I mean, obviously we have these three approved agents, and abiraterone's not on that list. Interestingly, it's in the guidelines for the AUA because of that particular issue, that it is generic. There's also the idea that you could take one pill with food and probably have similar drug levels, at least by PSA responses, and a small study that looked at this with food versus 4 without food. And really kind of getting the similar level of drug. Now, that is that study, which is a really nicely done one by Russell Smolowitz and the team at University of Chicago, I think demonstrates a probable effect, but it's not obviously a phase 3 trial. So when I have the ability to give one of the drugs that has been in a phase 3 registration trial that's approved for the indication, I do that. But we do have to do what we can to meet patients where they are and to get them the treatments that we know that are effective. There was a study, I think it's called the IMAGINE trial, that did look at this as a phase 2 and did suggest some benefit. Again, not a survival benefit, it's a phase 2. So I think there's rationale to try it. And we really do have to do, you know, when we practice medicine, we're just trying to get drug to patient to try to help them meet their needs and maintain their quality of life. And I think that abiraterone can do it. And when we don't have other options, we've got to do what we can for the patient.
So in terms of choice of anti-androgen, Evan reflected on that a little bit, talking about some of the indirect comparisons, particularly, I think, mainly in terms of toxicity. I am curious, Alicia, assuming you have everything available, what your favorite hormonal therapy is in the M0 setting and the metastatic endocrine-sensitive setting, and whether clinically you think you see a difference. One thing to look at data, do you think you see the difference in your patients?
So I have used and do use all of these agents. I do, in recent times for metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, reach more commonly for darolutamide because I think the study, the Arison study, is the cleanest that demonstrates that adding darolutamide to ADT docetaxel is going to get me that big bang for my buck. It also seems to have relatively fewer drug-drug interactions with the drugs that the patients I'm seeing in clinic on a day-to-day basis are taking. So from a data perspective, in that setting and an ease of giving drug, I like that drug. But I do use all of these agents, and sometimes it's the patient's insurance that dictates it. Sometimes it's little nuances, but they all seem to be effective. It's difficult, I think, in clinical practice to compare them to each other.
So, Evan, you were talking in the beginning about the amazing developments that have occurred, and this is one of the ones I think is most fascinating, really a signal maybe for oncology in general, lutetium, PSMA. Can you talk a little bit about your vision of how it works and right now where you think it fits in the algorithm?
Yeah, so lutetium PSMA-617, this is a radioligand therapy, and it basically has a small molecule that binds to PSMA, prostate-specific membrane antigen, that's highly expressed on prostate cancer, especially in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. And the whole idea is it has a beta-emitting radiopharmaceutical that when it finds its target, hopefully in prostate cancer, although there are other places that can express PSMA, for instance, salivary glands and tear ducts can as well, it deposits that beta emitter right there to have potent killing effect. And in the VISION trial and the therapy trial, it looks like there's clear benefits, and that's why it's FDA approved, and we're starting to use it now.
And again, hazard rate of 0.4. So, Alicia, just to tease out a little bit more, survival, a benefit, hazard rate 0.62, very impressive. These are data just presented a few weeks ago. Kind of made sense, was sort of interesting to see it. There's a real correlation when you see your PSA drop between that and PFS, and actually, I think survival as well. A very interesting study. Here's a survival. The high PSA responders are at the top, the minimal up to no decline, you can see much different. But also this question of sequencing, Alicia, and particularly the issue of what comes first, lutetium or chemotherapy, particularly cabazitaxel. And there's actually a study that was therapy that was actually updated at ASCO. Curious about your thoughts about that and where you would like to use lutetium.
So, lutetium and cabazitaxel are really in quite a similar space. They're both approved after progression on docetaxel, and then lutetium has the added layer of you need to have progression on an AR targeted agent as well, clearly in the label. And I think these are good opportunities for shared decision making, and also, of course, looking at the clinical features of the patient. There are patients who are in visceral crisis who we feel, I think, as oncologists, compelled to give chemotherapy, and sometimes even using combination chemotherapy. Some folks are throwing a little carboplatin in with their cabazitaxel to try to get a little more bang for their buck. And so we can use that as a guide. But what the overall survival data from therapy showed us, there it is that there's actually no difference in overall survival between these agents. And so importantly, I think this suggests that we have the option to use both. And my goal is to use both in every patient who's going to be fit for it, and hope that we can keep them safe and keep their bone marrow strong enough to be able to get both of these agents. One challenge I would point out that's different between these agents is that cabazitaxel, if I want it, I write it, I get it next week, or even this week if I have to for a patient who, again, is in more of a crisis. Lutetium requires a PSMA PET to identify patients, and in the therapy they had both a PSMA PET and an FDG PET to identify patients most likely to respond. And if they had more FDG positive lesions than PSMA PET positive lesions, they were actually not eligible to enroll in that trial. So patient selection is really important for use of lutetium, and that can be a key way to help make that decision too. If you have a patient who does not have a significant amount of PSMA expression on their PSMA PET, obviously that's not going to be even a decision decision. You're going to have to go with the cabazitaxel. And the final thing I would mention is that in the reality of our practices today, there are some supply chain issues with getting lutetium. We have to get the PET, and then we also have to get the drug. So we have to go through those two steps to actually get drug to patient. And I think that's just important in terms of timing and considerations. How soon does this patient need this treatment? Is it emergent, or can it wait a few weeks?
And of course, Evan, the other issue is, what's the patient going to go through when they get treatment, both in terms of toxicity, but also, like, where are they going to go? How often are they going to go? One of the things I've heard about is dry mouth. I'm curious whether you've seen that. What do these patients, what do you tell them when you present this option?
Yeah, for us as oncologists, it's generally a new side effect, unless you're dealing with, you know, head and neck cancer patients that are getting radiation. They have xerostomia as well. But for most of us, we don't see a lot of this. So it's a new side effect for us to think about. So it requires some counseling. Down the road, I think we'll have better, you know, agents, mechanisms to deal with dry mouth. However, at this point in time, it's really about telling the patient to avoid things that are going to dry them out further, alcohol, smoking. I ask my patients to use a humidifier at night to keep the room moist, xylitol gum, taking sips of water frequently. So there are tips. And, you know, like I said, in the head and neck xerostomia realm, there's, you know, a great ASCO abstract this year using acupuncture, and it was randomized against sham acupuncture. Clear benefits there in that setting. I don't know that we can import it over, but I'm curious to try it. And so I think that counseling of your patient is important to recognize this.
Double-blind study of acupuncture, I like it. So one other issue that I didn't think about, but I've had a number of people bring this up, Alicia, is the patient has bone-only mets. What comes first, lutetium or radium?
Another great question. You're just hitting hard today, aren't you? So great. These are the questions we face in practice. So again, a shared decision. We actually have evidence that lutetium can be safe after radium. Patients could have had radium and get into the vision trial. So I know that there's safety there. There are some suggestions and some expanded access and database analyses reports from cohorts of patients who have had lutetium and then radium. So I believe it is most likely safe. But the marrow effects from these two agents are things that, at least in vision, they required a separation of treatment between radium and lutetium by about 6 months, at least, I believe. So we have to think about, how do we support the marrow? Patients who are already having significant cytopenias, we may find ourselves in a situation where we have to choose between the two. If you have a bone-only patient, then really that's going to be up to you to look at the data and to figure out what you can get and what you can get approved and what you have access to. But I don't know that we certainly don't have head-to-head data to make that decision. So there has to be some level of, just personal preference, I think, as a clinician and a patient.
So I love it when the heme investigators, I'm talking to them about being in general medical oncology, and I go, did you know there are 5 lines of therapy approved in metastatic bladder cancer? So that is general medical oncology today. Evan, we asked you to talk a little bit about antibody-drug conjugates and targeted treatments / erdafitinib.
All right, thanks so much. The way I think about antibody drug conjugates is they really are targeted treatments, right? Because there's an antibody that finds a specific target and drops off a payload there. So they are targeted treatments as well. But with that being said and done, I think when people say targeted treatments, they're thinking about precision medicine with some genetic alteration. So the one in bladder cancer was with FGFR, fibroblast growth factor receptors. And so this was received accelerated approval based on this phase 2 study using erdafitinib, which is a pan FGFR inhibitor. And so it's a complex design, but I'll point to regimen 3, which is eventually they found the right dose, which was 8 milligrams a day with potential to up titration based on phosphate levels. Primary endpoint, objective response rates. And what you see there is it was about, 75% had FGFR3 mutations and 25% had FGFR2/3 translocations or fusions. So that being said and done, when you look at the data, the response rates are actually better for those patients who have mutations. I want to state that this is not a large study, around 100 patients, so we have to take it with a grain of salt, but we clearly see better response rates, better progression-free survival for those patients who have mutants versus those that have fusions, and the overall objective response rate was around 40% or so. In regards to safety, this has a slightly different safety profile. We've all seen, you know, the hand-foot syndrome and the nails and the stomatitis from other tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But the key differences here are that phosphate levels, hyperphosphatemia, this is a pharmacodynamic effect. This shows that, you know, you're actually hitting your target there. So that's one thing to watch out for. And central serous retinopathy, so you need to work with an ophthalmologist. That's another thing to watch out for. So this is now ongoing, the randomized phase 3 study. Obviously, accelerated approval, need to confirm it. So if you've received prior IO, the randomization is to erdafitinib versus taxane, dealer's choice of taxane. And if you haven't received prior IO, then it's erdafitinib versus pembrolizumab. I like that for these patients who have metastatic or locally advanced unresectable disease. And that's overall survival. Now, onto the antibody drug conjugates. Real quick, the construct design, you can see an antibody there. You have a linker. The linker is critical. The linker is very important because the idea is this protects the payload, which is a toxic payload. You don't want it just floating around. You want it where you want it, at the cancer cell. And so there are cleavable and non-cleavable linkers, and there may be benefits to having a more cleavable linker. There might be benefits to having a less cleavable linker. For instance, we've seen some data in breast cancer where less cleavable, more cleavable linkers might work well for HER2-low patients with trastuzumab deruxtecan. But with that being said and done, the whole idea is you find your target, an endosome gets formed, so it gets phagocytized inside the cell. It fuses to a lysosome where the pH is low, and boom, that's where the linker gets clipped, and then that releases the payload inside the cell. Now, Nectin-4 is the target of enfortumab vedotin, and this was thought to be expressed maybe in about 60% of patients. When we started doing the clinical trials, we found it was expressed much, much higher than that. And so that being said and done, you know, we've seen good survival data, which I'll get to, but, and you know, Nectin-4 is expressed in other cancers as well, for instance, lung cancer, and it's being studied in those diseases. So this is a randomized phase 3 study. This is really third line therapy, so patients get platinum, they've had IO, and they got randomized to enfortumab versus taxane. And overall survival being the primary endpoint, you can see the clear difference in the survival curves there. The hazard ratio, very significant, 0.7, with a very nice p-value as well. And the key treatment-related adverse events to pay attention to, I would say, are peripheral sensory neuropathy, okay, because the payload is monomethyl auristatin E, MMAE, which is a microtubule inhibitor, so it makes sense. A lot of these patients already have neuropathy from prior platinum, so peripheral sensory neuropathy needs to be paid attention to. Some patients can get hyperglycemia. It tends to be patients that have higher BMIs as well, but otherwise you can get skin changes as well. It's generally mild skin rash, but you can... There is a black box warning for Stevens-Johnson syndrome. It's rare, but it can happen as well. Now, there's also an approval, not just in the third line, but for those who are cisplatin ineligible. And it was based on this study where they received IO in the first line, they were cisplatin ineligible, and then received enfortumab. You see the highest objective response rates that we see with any agents in metastatic bladder cancer at 52%. So this got looped into the approval. So if you have somebody that is progressing after first-line therapy, and it doesn't have to be IO, the FDA label was loose, it's any first-line therapy, they can receive enfortumab vedotin, which has a high response rate.
And, you know, looking at those waterfall plots, and you don't really need to select people. Everything is going down.
Right, exactly. Now, this is the latest and greatest, the newest thing, is combination enfortumab with pembrolizumab. First line, cisplatin-ineligible patients, and I almost fell out of my chair at ESMO when I first saw this data. 73% response rates, 93% of patients have shrinkage of disease, so we had to see it again in cohort K here, and this was randomized to either enfortumab or enfortumab plus pembrolizumab in this first line setting, and what you can see is still very high response rate, 64.5%. For EV alone, it was 45%. That being said and done, this was not statistically designed to be comparative, but it just gives you an idea what you see of single agent versus combination therapy. And this combination of enfortumab plus pembrolizumab is being studied in this randomized phase 3 trial that we're waiting for the results. It's obvious, it's basically just enfortumab pembro versus gemcitabine platinum, and you can decide whether the patient's eligible for cisplatin or not eligible, in which case you'd give carboplatin, and we'll wait to see what the data shows. shows from this study. There was a third arm there, which was combination of fortamab, pembrolizumab, and cisplatin, but they decided not to do that, and that got canned. Now, the other antibody-drug conjugate that's FDA-approved is sacituzumab govitecan, and you're familiar with this from breast cancer patients. The target's TROP2. It's highly expressed in bladder cancer as well. The payload is SN38, the active metabolite from irinotecan, and you can see the original data. The waterfall plots look nice there. This is also in the third line as well. And based on this study, TROPHY-U01, you can see a response rate around 30% there, a nice waterfall plot. And it's received accelerated approval also in the third line post-platinum, post-IO for this. The toxicities are based on the payload, and it's based on what you would see in the old days with irinotecan: neutropenia, diarrhea, febrile neutropenia. So about a third of the patients had to receive G-CSF, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. Randomized phase 3 trial that's ongoing is really in the third line again, post-platinum, post-IO, sacituzumab versus taxane, dealer's choice. And we'll see what happens there. I do want to finish with the fact that HER2 isn't alive and back again as a candidate target for bladder cancer. It is highly expressed, maybe in about 15% plus, depending upon which study you look at. Some data with trastuzumab deruxtecan plus nivolumab with response rates in the 35% range. That being said and done, hard to tease out the independent components there. Tucatinib, which we know can be used in breast cancer, that's a small molecule inhibitor in combination with trastuzumab there. We'll have to wait and see the data, but we know that that trial is ongoing. And disitamab vedotin, this is another antibody drug conjugate. This also uses MMAE and uses this a very potent linker like in infortimab. And you can see here, for HER, it's the response rates are higher for those with higher HER2 expression. 3+ has the highest response rates, but even in HER2 1+, we do see some responders based on these waterfall plots. And in combination with another IO agent in China, toripalimab, you can see very high response rates there, 71.8%. And there's an ongoing phase 2 that's just started off. I won't go over this in great detail, but it's really exploring the use of disitamab as a single agent or disitamab plus pembrolizumab. So to wrap up there, FGFR inhibitors, erdafitinib, FGFR2-3 alterations, antibody drug conjugates, approval for infortimab there in the third line or in the second line if you're cisplatin ineligible. Sacituzumab has approval there in the third line and beyond, and there's a lot of promising agents coming. HER2's a new target for ADCs. Thanks so much.
So, you know, I'm always into names. Did I see that HER2zumab was the... HER2.
Right.
So one of my few jokes in oncology is, you know, we've been talking about anti-HER3 antibodies. We were talking about that in lung cancers or about that. So anti-HER3 antibodies, I call trastuzumab. How's that?
Yeah, HER2zumab is, you know, different than trastuzumab. It binds to a different epitope, but it also binds to HER2 as well. So it's just a different antibody, whereas, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan just uses the trastuzumab antibody. This is a slightly different antibody.
So the other thing I was just going to mention before we go, one is, at least you were talking about all these good questions, all that comes from them, particularly our chat room. And I see the leader of our chat room from the FCS, Dr. Kumar, sitting here in the first row. Half the time, I don't even understand the questions they're asking. I got to look it up in the middle of the webinar. But it has really been amazing doing webinars these last few years, the kind of input we get in the chat room. We really appreciate it. We appreciate it to you virtual people out there today. Well, let's explore a little bit of this. And we also are getting a bunch of questions about prostate, so maybe we can go back to that at the end. All right. So let's go through a few other issues as it relates to bladder cancer. One thing that we haven't talked about is non-muscle invasive disease, Alicia. And of course, we've seen the evolution beyond BCG. We're seeing a pembrolizumab now approved in that setting, very controversial. Although in people not eligible for cystectomy, makes a lot of sense. Also, even targeted therapy, there are trials looking at erdafitinib. It's very highly expressed and non-muscle invasive. I'm not sure how often oncologists are actually seeing these patients or how often you see them, but just curious about your perspective about these patients.
Yeah, so I certainly don't see many of them unless urologists send them over for that BCG refractory setting for consideration of pembrolizumab. But one thing that is clear is that there is a BCG shortage and that they need options beyond BCG. So I'm very excited that they're thinking about using different modes of delivery and different agents to try to still stimulate that immune irritation on the inside of the bladder wall and get some sort of activity and then hopefully some cancer-fighting activity to resolve that non-muscle invasive disease. I think you have questions here about TAR-200, which is really fascinating to think about, again, these different modes of delivery, because from a patient survivorship perspective, when I talk to patients who have to get that BCG instillation or anything else intravesical and sit for a long time, an hour or whatever that instillation period is, and then kind of waddle the way to the restroom and release all of that, it can be really irritating. So having these novel modes of delivery that may be as effective or perhaps even more effective, I think is really exciting. But I don't see many of these patients unless the urologists have sent them along because things are not working.
Evan, any comments about non-muscle invasive disease? How do you feel about using pembrolizumab? I showed the data that we have on that. And also this TAR-200 really is intravesicular gemcitabine. They call it a pretzel. They sort of slide it in and it curls up into a pretzel, delivers continuous gemcitabine, and they put other stuff in there. They put erdafitinib in there. Again, any thoughts about non-muscle invasive disease?
Yeah, non-muscle invasive disease is very important because it's very common, and it's a costly disease to treat because of recurrent need for more and more cystoscopies and TURs. And so with that being said and done, you know, the first line treatment for somebody who's had BCG and become unresponsive to BCG is cystectomy if your patient can handle it. Now, some patients refuse it, some patients are not, ideal candidates for cystectomy. So that's where it's important that we have agents like pembrolizumab there, and we do have an approval for pembrolizumab there. There are a lot of other intravesicular therapies that Alicia alluded to that looked really promising, but for various reasons didn't make it. I think this TAR-200 is potentially interesting. It's like this pretzel that has, delayed gemcitabine release into the bladder, so it might be of use for non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, but is an unmet need, and I just think that we need to keep doing more research, and there's a lot of promising agents out there.
So in addition to all this interesting stuff going on in the metastatic setting, also we have adjuvant therapy, and of course this is the big adjuvant NEVO study that now is approved, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about how and when you utilize it. I'm not exactly clear what kind of risk you need to have to whether you use the trial. I don't know that the FDA says exactly what the risk is, but I'm curious who you treat with.
Yeah, so I do actually try to follow what's on the clinical trial and the enrollment criteria. So these are, big remaining tumors, post neoadjuvant therapy, node positive disease, or if they haven't had neoadjuvant therapy, node positive disease or a large tumor. And I think that, this is, to me, really compelling, though we have to be aware that this is a disease-free survival endpoint on which this was, approved, and we're waiting for that overall survival data. I think despite the fact that this is not overall survival data, we all know what happens to patients with bladder cancer when the disease comes back. And so this is extremely meaningful, at least to patients in my practice, and I was just grateful the FDA felt that way and also approved it in this setting.
Again, Evan, I don't really see that the FDA said exactly what kind of risk you need, and everybody sort of goes, well, okay, we'll use the trial, but is that what you do?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people focus on PD-L1 because the patients had PD-L1 high staining seem to do better. Well, that is true, but that's not the most important factor for me. The most important factor for me are the two patient populations that they really accrued, one of which are those that receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy and have residual disease, as Alicia alluded to, because those patients have a very poor prognosis, and it's an unmet need, and so this helps fill that. The other population are those patients that for some reason or another maybe had too many comorbidities to receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy. They didn't get the benefit of systemic therapy. So for those patients, T3 or greater, T3 or node positive disease, I'll treat. For the patients that received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, residual T2 or greater, I will treat.
So, you know, the breast cancer people say, well, just calculate the benefit and go down, but everybody has their different approach to it. Let's talk a little bit, elaborate a little bit more some of the other things that Evan was talking about, beginning with erdafitinib. Alicia, and I'm curious about your experience with the agent. Also, the hyperphosphatemia is an unusual thing for an oncologist to deal with. How do you prevent and manage it?
Yeah, so I have most of my experience was actually in the initial study with that, and I have used it relatively minimally through standard of care, given the number of options that are now available. And besides the complications that Evan talked about, there are some nail changes that can be a little bit debilitating for patients. The hyperphosphatemia is very much outside of our world. So we always start with dietary changes and certainly ensuring that they're following that low phosphate diet that they need to have. And then there are binders that people can use that are usually when patients get to this point, they're pretty willing to be compliant, but that can be a challenge as well.
What about enfortumab? What's your experience in terms of tolerability, Alicia? And where would you like to use it at this point?
Well, I think that the most compelling data, besides the compelling data that led to the initial approval, is actually that combination with pembrolizumab for enfortumab vedotin. I would love to be able to use that combination. I'd love to be able to use it in as early a line as I possibly can. I mentioned earlier that at least in GU oncology, the earlier we use our effective therapies, the better they seem to do in terms of the magnitude of benefit for patients. And so I'd love to be able to move that forward. I really, for anyone who hasn't used the agent, it can be quite tolerable, even for older patients. I've had patients in their 90s using this, patients who have some non-healing ulcers on their legs from lymphedema that we just continue to have wound care and they're still getting their EV and they are tolerating well without infections. Always important to be cautious, of course, but it can be tolerable even in our oldest patients and highly effective. Once we stop the agent, I find that I can have a patient have a treatment-free interval with no disease progression, sometimes a year plus, which is also a little bit unusual in oncology. But the cautionary tale, I would say, is the blood sugar can be an issue. Making sure that blood sugar is less than 250, always have to do, because you could have a DKA type event. And the other issue is neuropathy. It is very important from my perspective to be really proactive in terms of changing schedule and dose reduction to prevent what can be an extremely debilitating neuropathy for patients. So on the front end, make sure you catch it when it's a sensory neuropathy. It can progress to motor neuropathy or could be manifest in your patient as a motor neuropathy. So just being very cautious there, dose reducing, changing schedule.
You know, it's interesting when you hear investigators talking about things they're excited about. There's certain things that you can tell, like we were talking about pirtobrutinib earlier, like why isn't it here? And that, you know, I keep hearing this thing about enfortumab plus IO. And actually, when you think about it, it makes sense because we know chemo plus IO, I mean, standard of care in lung cancer, well, this is targeted chemo plus IO. Evan, do you share that enthusiasm? Would you like to be able to do that right now?
Yeah, I would. I think the data looks amazing. Interestingly, platinum plus IO didn't really work out in bladder cancer, but I will be surprised if this doesn't work out. And the two situations I'd love to use it for, I'd love to use enfortumab pembro for first-line therapy for everyone to take over platinum. I'm not saying platinum's dead. I still like the fact that it could save it for later, but that would I'd like that to be my first-line therapy down the road. And the other big unmet need are cisplatin-ineligible patients with muscle-invasive disease that are undergoing cystectomy. We have no systemic therapy for them. We know they have a high risk of recurrence. We know there's likely often micrometastatic disease there. There is nothing for that patient population. So enfortumab pembro could be given to a lot of patients that are cisplatin-ineligible, especially if it's because of, you know, chronic kidney injury or something.
So, yeah, what about neoadjuvant enfortumab IO? Yeah. You're up for that?
Yeah, that's exactly the situation. Cisplatin ineligible, neoadjuvant. Yeah,
wow.
For those patients that are ineligible for cisplatin, give them the enfortumab, pembro, and then cystectomy.
So just a few final comments, questions that we got during the prostate part earlier. Alicia, talking about combinations, someone wants to know about IO plus PARP. in HR deficient. We were talking about that prostate cancer. Any thoughts about that? Trials looking at that.
Yeah. So, and I don't know if Evan has any thoughts about that too. I don't. That, you know, Evan, do you want to comment?
That's my negative randomized phase 3 trial with Merck.
PI.
So, pembro plus olaparib, and it was in the post docetaxel setting, post 1AR targeted therapy. So, pembro plus olaparib randomized to switch. So, if you had enzalutamide, you'd go to Abby. If you had Abby, you'd go to enzalutamide. And I presented it. It's unfortunately negative for PFS and overall survival. There's a higher response rate with pembro olaparib, but the study's negative.
And you hear about that in ovary also, that kind of strategy of PARP plus IO. We'll see where that's heading. Another question, quote, any pearls about managing cognitive decline in elderly patients on ADT and AR inhibitors in metastatic disease? Many elderly patients have ongoing cognitive decline. Any pearls?
Sure. So first, we have to identify it in order to be able to stop or reverse it. So asking questions not just of the patient, but of the caregivers, the loved ones in the room, can be really enlightening because, for example, I saw a patient just this last week who has a diagnosis of dementia, is aware of that diagnosis, was in without his wife, and told me he's great. And his wife calls in later and said, he's definitely declined in the last month and a half since you started the ADT. And we really kind of dug into some clear examples of how that's happening, because there's not always the self-reflection that these issues are happening. So hearing from loved ones is important. You can't do anything about it until you identify it. The other piece that I would say is that there are reversible aspects of life that can absolutely contribute to or mimic or worsen cognitive decline. So things like depression, sleep disorders, those are things that we can intervene upon. We can treat depression. We can treat sleep apnea. We can treat other fatigue with other ways, you know, trying to use exercise and those kinds of things, because these things that can worsen a cognitive decline or mimic cognitive decline are things that we might be able to reverse. And then finally, engaging as much as possible with our neurology colleagues, because the patient may have true dementia that can be intervened upon with pharmacologic agents, not to necessarily reverse it, but to slow it down. And there are also cognitive rehabilitation things that we can do, including online things, not necessarily some that have been debunked a little bit in recent literature, but there are cancer-directed cognitive programs that people can at least engage in for fun, and these sort of brain games may be able to, in some preliminary studies, help with multitasking with other aspects of cognitive function.
One final prostate-related question, Evan. Patients who require ADT, but with prior cardiac disease, you hear people talking about using antagonists, and also you have an oral agent, relugolix. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the relugolix study, there were fewer major cardiac events in that New England Journal paper that was published. However, there was another study, the PRONOUNCE study, I believe, that looked at that issue using degarelix, and the whole focus of the study was looking at major cardiac events. So that was just a secondary endpoint or in the relugolix study, but this was the primary endpoint, and there was no benefit. As a matter of fact, there were more major cardiac events with the LHRH antagonist than there were with the agonist. So I think the jury's still out. I'm personally not necessarily convinced that antagonists have lower cardiac adverse events. The good news is that these events happen generally further out. These events generally happen after longer-term exposure. And the risk-benefit ratio is clearly in favor of benefit and treatment. So there's small number of events, and they happen further out. And, you know, I think we still got to treat our patients that need it.
Final comment from Courtney. Just kidding.
Thank you. So I would just say that I'd be very cautious with the PRONOUNCE data if you're looking that up on your own. That study barely accrued half of its expected accrual, so really does not have the power to answer the question that was asked. And the other piece that they had the luxury of that we don't have in our practices is actually a cardiologist or a cardio-oncologist was engaged in the management of every single patient in that trial. And so if you have that kind of engagement, and hopefully we will for our patients with multiple cardiac comorbidities, I think we can shift their cardiovascular risk aside from ADT. But the data from the adverse events in the HERO trial, from my perspective, is at least compelling enough for those highest risk patients to use that as an approach to ADT.
Thank you so much.